Would you like to stand a chance of winning a registration for our upcoming deep dive virtual retreat so you can learn from incredible agents, editors, and authors while also having the chance of winning life-changing prizes? Head to theshitaboutwriting.com and go to the deep dive page. Scroll down past all the details of the amazing lineup to find an image that you can share on your socials along with the reasons why you would like to attend. Use the hashtag deep dive or bust and tag the podcast. Each post gets you a ticket into the draw. The contest ends at midnight on the 23rd of January and the winner will be announced on the 24th. We hope it's going to be you.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for the writer in your life? Are you the favorite writer in your life and you want to gift yourself something awesome? Then come take a look at the Ultimate Planner for Writers for 2025. It not only allows you to plan for your regular day-to-day with hourly time slots, it also allows you to brainstorm, research, plot, outline, do scene planning, and vision boarding all in one. And it's available as a physical planner or as an e-planner. Check out Bianca Murray and find the Planner for Writers tab for more information. Remember to order early to avoid the end of year rush. Hi there and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Hi everyone, welcome back to another Books with Hooks, our first one of the year. Carly, would you like to welcome everyone?
All right, everybody, welcome to the new year. We always record into the future, so I'm coming from the past to welcome you guys into the future. Happy New Year, another year of Books with Hooks. This is 4 year, I've lost track, literally, of 4 year. Our official 4 year anniversary. I should look up what, you know, like every anniversary year, it's like a thing that we like, I don't know, wood or like metal, I don't know, we figure out what our 4 year anniversary is. But we're so glad you guys have been along in this ride with us. It's hard to believe we have been doing this for this long. I mean, as somebody who has been reading query letters for a decade and a half, I've spent a lot of time with your query letters. So it's really interesting for me to be like, you guys have literally seen in my head for the last 4 years in terms of how I think and how I analyze things and how I evaluate. So anyway, thank you to all of you for being here with us to kick off another year. We are thrilled you're listening and thrilled you're here. Okay, I'm going to start by reading my query letter. Dear Carly Waters, Vince Kern is not your average wrongful death attorney. Having grown up with his childhood heroes, Perry Mason and Atticus Finch, Vince's idealism sets him apart. Much like his old man Jacob, Vince is a straight shooter who strives to do what's right, no matter the cost. Nonetheless, when Vince and Jacob travel from Seattle to the family farm in South Dakota, Vince soon finds himself caught between family and clients, and seemingly overnight, what was black and white has become gray. A Fragile Hostility, 85,000 words, is an upmarket story of love lost and the power of roots and forgiveness to save us. My manuscript is similar in style and tone to Sarah Vaughan's The Farm at the End of the World, in theme to Tara Shelton Harris's One Summer in Savannah, and in pace and suspense to Robert Dugoni's The Extraordinary Life of Sam Hell, all tales of loss and the power of forgiveness. Vince is up to his eyeballs, working to find justice for the death of the Pritchard's daughter, when he reluctantly agrees to a trip to the family farm. While there, Jacob undergoes emergency surgery, and Vince learns that his father has terminal cancer and that Aunt Grace is struggling to hold on to the farm, all while Vince's mother is haunting him, begging forgiveness for a betrayal he only wants to forget. Angry and grieving, Vince knows he must return to Seattle or risk sacrificing the Pritchard case to his greedy boss. Torn between leaving his father or losing the case of his career, Vince puts work ahead of family. After Jacob dies, Vince, overcome with remorse, makes a fatal mistake in court. He is suspended, thereby sacrificing the Pritchard case, and wallows for weeks before returning to work after his boss admits the Pritchards are insisting he come back. He soon learns, however, that Aunt Grace is struggling with dementia and is no longer safe alone on the farm. She needs him, and once again, Vince must choose between clients and family, but only his ability to forgive will help him decide. The story was inspired by my father, who was an avid gardener and died from cancer, and my mother, who died from Alzheimer's. When Thomas Cobb, author of Crazy Heart, read a sample of my debut, he called it graceful and wonderfully imagined. I hope you agree. Several of my short stories were published in a national award-winning literary magazine, and I have also had poetry published. I continually work to improve my writing skills through writing classes, instructional books, and constant reading. I live in the Seattle area for 9 years and have degrees in paralegal studies, psychology, and public health. I currently live with my husband in sweltering Tucson, Arizona, trying to stay cool. Thank you for your time and consideration and for all you do to help aspiring writers such as myself. Patricia Pat Canterbury.
Awesome, Carly. Thank you. Before we go into the actual query letter and the word count, etc., something I want to tell our listeners that I'm super excited about this year is so many of the authors that we have lined up for this year's schedule are people who submitted to Books with Hooks, who started listening to our podcast. So this is the incredible thing, is that we are now starting to have so many authors on who began with this, with submitting a query letter or writing a query letter. And that's super, super exciting to us. Okay, Carly, what was the word count there and what's your take on that?
All right, this one clocked in at 463 words. So a little bit on the longer side. And we can get into it. So here we go. So as I said, I've been reading queries for a decade and a half. I've seen every iteration of spelling of my name. I will say I have not seen the spelling of my name before it. C-A-R-L-Y-E, and then only one T in Waters. So just a reminder to everybody, my name is all over the show. My name's all over the internet. You can always figure out how to spell my name. And I would assume, again, that we're pitching the show, that you're pitching me, that you guys know how to spell my name. And it's one of those things where I always feel like such a Grinch about it, because it's like, it's just my name, da 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 da. But when you are addressing a business letter to somebody and you want them to start, it's kind of like an interview, right? You're like walking into a situation and you always want to start off on the best foot. And so if I'm starting off on a foot of being like, that's not me, that's not my name, and then I'm like going into the next paragraph being like, I have that energy. You know what I'm trying to say? So like, you always want to start off on the right foot. And I know that you guys know this, but I'm just reiterating, you want to put me in the best headspace as the person reading this, right? And so it's your first opportunity to be like, okay, let's get Carly in the right headspace. And so by spelling my name wrong, it's one of those things where it's like, I'm not in the right headspace now, right? And it's just, again, a simple thing that you can do, obviously, to put yourself on the right foot. Okay, so your first paragraph, I wouldn't start with this. And the reason is I don't really have any context for it. The reason I like starting with either just like a log line straight up, or that, which is the second paragraph this person has, which is the title and the word count and all of that stuff and the comps, is because we need to kind of have a framed understanding of what is happening. Like, I, based on this first paragraph, I don't know if this is literary, if it's crime, if it's historical, which again, the combination of my name not being spelled right and then a paragraph where I have no idea what category to put this in bucket wise. I'm moving on to the next paragraph, still not really sure what this book is about. And now I'm like, okay, I get our title. So I would put this in all caps, A Fragile Hostility. I actually really like this title. I think this is a great title. Now I'm like, again, what is this book? And your comps are a little bit kind of all over the place in terms of what they're about. You kind of address this by saying, you know, similar in style and tone to this, you know, and theme to this, and pace and suspense to this, but you're comping historical, contemporary Southern fiction, and then historical coming of age. So I'm going to assume based on this, it's probably historical, but you're calling this upmarket with a lawyer protagonist. So I'm thinking, okay, what are we exactly getting into here in terms of his profession versus family and all of that other life stuff? The word forgiveness is used a couple times in the second paragraph. So we, you know, think of yourself like a poet, right? We don't need to be duplicating words in such a short amount of space here. And so you're going to want to look at how often you use the word forgiveness. Okay, now let's get into our protagonist and what the book is about here. So I guess what I'm struggling with a little bit with this pitch is that balance between the professional and the personal, which I think is always a good push and pull, but I don't quite understand how this Pritchard case is so important necessarily. It's obviously tragic. This family's daughter, you know, child has died, obviously tragic. He's a wrongful death attorney. So like, there is emotionality and feeling here, but I don't know how this is going to come off, but like, other than professionally, how connected is he to this family? You know, I think there'd be so much more meaning and depth here if there was like a reason that he took on this case. But I guess, I don't know, for professional reasons or confidentiality, whether you can work with somebody you know. But what's the other layer here? If we're going to believe this deeply in this case, why does he want this case? Is it only to advance his career? Well, then he's coming off really callous because he's like obviously putting his career above his family. So I think we need a bit more of a, you know, push-pull, you know, career, the identity piece versus like the family and like what we're trying to escape. Because to me, I'm reading this and I'm like, who cares? Like, if your dad is sick and like your family farm is struggling, you know, is there a reason he needs this job? Is he struggling for money? Does he have to pay alimony? Like what is the reason that he needs the money from working this case? Is it, you know, he wants that money to specifically improve the farm? Like, I'm just not seeing the links between these things, which I think is just an opportunity that's potentially missed here. The other thing is that none of this is really about him. His identity as a lawyer is clearly important to him, but like, again, not, this isn't about him. This is about his job. This is about the Pritchard case. It's not like his daughter has died. It is, again, a case in the case. This has happened. And then the family farm, it seems like he's close with his dad, but he's very reluctant to be kind of drawn back into all of these family issues. So if he is resisting the closeness with the family, and then we're not fully connected to the potential emotionality of his connection to his work, then he is just kind of a sitting duck, in my opinion, in my read of this query letter. Again, that's just my personal read, as always. So that's how it's landing for me. And yeah, again, it's just one person's take on one day, but that's where I'm at with this one.
Thank you, Carly. Yeah, you know, remember for our listeners that when we say things like, who cares, what we're saying is, why should we care? Why does it matter? And it's so important for us as writers to make that clear in our queries to agents so that they immediately do care and they immediately do know why it matters, as opposed to having to grapple with, so why does this matter? And that is our job as writers, is to make sure that that is very clear. Okay, Cece, we're handing it across to you.
Few quick micro notes. The paragraph with all the metadata, which I agree should be the first paragraph, that's the one with your comps. The last clause, you don't need it. Like, all tales of loss and the power of forgiveness, we already know that they are tales that are comparable to your work. So you're just adding extra words there. And that's a quick fix that could improve your word count. I am probably the only person who thought of this and who will think of it. But in your plot paragraph, when you write that Vince's mother was haunting him, I was like, oh, is there a ghost? So I don't know. I would always be careful with the word haunt in a plot paragraph, because I think literal haunting. It's really not a big deal, but I would just choose a different word. You don't need the apostrophe in the last mention of the Pritchards. As we record this, it's December and everyone is misusing apostrophe in holiday cards. And so this is very thematic. Again, minor thing that you can just remove. You know, when it comes to the choice, personal and work, I agree that we are not being, it's not being presented in a way that's compelling. In life, everyone, not everyone, but it's quite a common choice and it's actually quite compelling for someone's life. But the best way to frame this in a story, I think, is to show sacrifice and to show cost. And so what is the cost of him going back to this farm? You know, is it a place that haunts him metaphorically? Is it a place where he suffers? Is it a place where he has bad memories, where, I don't know, he lost his mother once upon a time and he promised to never go back, you know? And when it comes to work, is the reason why he decided to be so passionate about his work and he just, you know, dedicates his career to that, is it like, what is the larger reason, I guess I'm saying? And it's not just about establishing that with a sentence, but it's about framing everything in a way that makes it seem like it's about the protagonist. Because to Carly's point, it is very untethered to Vince right now. Like, Vince is just there and it could be anyone else. And the story could just happen without Vince almost. So I do think that there is a potential here, but it's about reframing it to really focus on the protagonist as the son of the story.
Thank you, Cece. Yeah, and I don't know about you, but for me, something that always feels more powerful in terms of word usage is redemption rather than just forgiveness. Like, for me, redemption is always much more active, much more powerful than forgiveness. So consider that. Okay, Carly, we're handing it back to you now in terms of the summary of those opening pages.
All right, so we start with chapter one called A Better Man. We start in medias res. We are in a moment where the son character and the father character are having a barbecue, and we start right into the conversation about wanting to go back to the farm. It's a very kind of cinematic scene. It's September. They're talking about, you know, barbecuing on the grill and the sounds and the smells and the sights of the moment that they're having together. They seem to be pretty close. You know, they're talking about their, you know, collective history, about learning how to kind of plant together. They're talking about tomatoes. They're talking about baseball. They are drinking scotch, specifically Glenfiddich, for anybody who is a scotch drinker out there. And yeah, so they're kind of just going back and forth in terms of dialogue about, you know, what they're eating versus the discussion about going back to the farm and whether that is going to work and whether they can drag him there.
Great, Carly. Thank you. Okay, will you give us your take on that?
All right. So I kind of mentioned this really quickly in my query overview, but I'm not entirely clear if this is contemporary or historical. And I feel like this is a theme that's coming up a bunch on the show lately, where, again, comps were historical. There's nothing specifically grounding this in the present. I would suggest potentially a timestamp or just figuring out some way to make it more clear whether this is historical or not, because some of the references that make me super kind of confused all over the place is, like, there's a Grapes of Wrath mention. It's the dad, you know, it says he could have been a character straight out of the Grapes of Wrath. That's a very specific historical reference. And then they talk about they're listening to the ball game on an old transistor radio. And again, it could be one of those things where it's an old radio, but, like, it's modern in the sense that they kind of have it in their contemporary home. I believe there was another mention of having a microwave or something like that, and how that was different from him growing up. So yeah, I just don't know at all what time and place we're in. And that's something that's super grounding for me, is just knowing how in my mind to kind of cinematically bring this to life as I'm reading. So that would be very important to me. The next thing is, it does feel a little bit on the nose to kind of jump right into the conversation about, you know, going back to the farm and how this all connects us. And, you know, I have a couple notes. You guys who are Substack subscribers will see my notes, but I have some notes where it's like, this is a little bit on the nose in terms of talking about the relationship to each other and the gardening and growing up. And I don't know. I just think there is so much potential here, because what I think you're really good at is some of these cinematic elements, which is describing, like, the birds and the environment. So I think you have so much, like, clearly you're very aware as a writer of trying to make this cinematic. So you are focusing on, like, as I said, birds and the feel of the kind of chilly nights. And anyway, so I think you do a great job with that, with, like, the food, and you do a great job describing food. But I think what we're missing is, again, some of these other opportunities to be a little bit less on the nose. I think there's a lot of potential there. And so one thing I wanted to point out, which kind of echoes what I was saying about the query letter critique, which is at the end of the sample, they're kind of going back and forth, the dad and the son, about whether they should make the trip back to the farm. And then he says, "I look away. Why now?" I said again, "The Pritchard, you and I both know there's always going to be another Pritchard case," he said, raising his hands. And I'm like, that's how I feel, like, as a reader. I'm like, what is it about this Pritchard case? Like, what is it? We're just missing something here about why he feels so connected to this being part of his identity and this legacy making thing of his career. Whatever it is, you have to figure it out. And maybe you do, and I'm just not privy to that information because of the small size of my sample. And maybe the query letter is putting too much emphasis on the Pritchard case. Like, maybe we need to do an entire reframing of this pitch, because maybe it's not about the Pritchard case at all. Maybe it is about something else. So I have a lot of question marks still. The big ones for me being, what period of time are we in? Why are we so on the nose specifically about, you know, naming everything you kind of want to hit home with the reader in these opening pages? And things that are really cinematic are great, but we need to balance that out a little bit more with some of these elements.
Thank you, Carly. Before we hand across to Cece, for those of you who missed last week's episode, it's Kate Fagan, and she speaks a lot about leaning into your strengths as a writer and her knowing that her strengths were writing memoir and her strengths were writing nonfiction and doing certain things, and then really leaning into that with her debut fiction. So, you know, it's always wonderful when someone points out our strengths. And hopefully you are aware of this as the author, but, you know, it's lovely when someone points that out, and make sure that you lean into that throughout your work. Okay, handing it over to Cece now.
I want to echo the note about this being on the nose. This is actually a super common mistake, I'm using air quotes, when it comes to the first five pages or any really opening pages. It is a matter of taste. There are books out there that start and they're quite on the nose and they work and they have, you know, fans, and that's great. For my taste, it is way too on the nose because I prefer a more subtle entry point into a story because that allows for surprise and it allows for buildup, right? It allows me to spend time with the character before I get that big thematic question. I did want to read a little excerpt here. Truth was, I didn't want to feel what he was asking of me. Our passions were as different as the sun and the moon, fire and ice. I was all right with that, but I could always feel the weight of his sadness and disappointment, even now sitting across from him. This is interiority. The protagonist's dad is asking him to care for the land like he does. And the protagonist is saying, you know, this is just not for me. Please note how beautiful these sentences are, right? And I think you should use this paragraph that I read and use everything else that's here in a different place. I don't think it's your starting point because it is too on the nose, because it is too obvious, and it just doesn't allow for the emotionality to land when it happens so fast. As another note, I also noticed that there was no interiority baked into the dialogue. I did highlight that for you. Our Substack subscribers will be able to see that. It is really important to have interiority baked into the dialogue. That means that in your dialogue tags and in your action beats, there should be sprinkles of interiority throughout, or else it reads like a screenplay and you don't want that. This is a book. As a final note, maybe there's a really good reason for this, but the fact that he mentioned his client's name to his dad kind of made me think this isn't super plausible or believable, because lawyers typically are very, very cautious when it comes to confidentiality and privilege. And it might seem like, so what? It's a name. You just don't mention anything. Like, it's drilled into you that you just act like a complete idiot and just smile and nod and say nothing. But maybe there's a reason. Maybe the dad knows the Pritchards. Maybe the dad is the one who referred him to the case. So like, there might be a reason for this. But if not, then change it. So yeah, those are my notes.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, we are now going to go to our second query letter. Cece, will you please read that for us?
I know you've been following along with my vacation updates, and as you know, we're off to France this summer. Between the French Riviera and Paris, I am going to need some French language training so I do not embarrass myself abroad, and I will be working on my French with Rosetta Stone all winter to get ready. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, and it truly immerses you in the language you want to learn. My husband and I are both going to focus on Rosetta Stone together as a New Year's resolution, so we're ready for vacation and to set a good example for the kids culturally, because learning a language of where you're traveling to is a sign of respect. We can't always assume that people speak English. We love Rosetta Stone. It is a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. There's fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really get to speak, listen, and think in your new language. It's an intuitive process designed to pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. There is speech recognition. They have a true accent feature, which gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It is convenient. There is flexible learning on an app or desktop or laptop on your schedule. There's amazing value, a lifetime membership of 25 languages for any and all trips and language needs in your life. That's lifetime access to all 25 language courses Rosetta Stone offers for 50% off, a steal. Start the new year off with a resolution you can reach. Today, the Shit About Writing listeners can take advantage of this Rosetta Stone lifetime membership offer for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Get a book deal is on many 2025 New Year's resolution lists for our listeners. But working in the creative industry, I've seen lots of writers and illustrators feel squeamish around money conversations. And what is a book deal but a financial offer for your creative output? We should all love talking about money. As a literary agent, I love talking about money and how its growth can improve people's lives. And that's why debunking money conversations are important. Like, many people think you need loads of money to start investing, or they put off investing because it seems like a later problem. Or creatives who deal with art and writing don't have time or passion to research and manage something like investments. That is why I'm thrilled that today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. You've heard me talk about Acorns before. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically, saving and investing so your money has a chance to grow for you, your kids, and your retirement. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that fits you and your money goals. You don't need to be rich. Acorns lets you invest with the spare money you've got right now. You can start with $5 or even just your spare change. Growing up as a young girl who was told she wasn't good at math, investing definitely scared me, but I am very proud to say that I've overcome all those mindset concerns, and I love talking about investing and how money can be given a chance to grow over time with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/TSNOTYAW or download the Acorns app and start saving and investing for your future today. This is a paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorn Advisors LLC is an SEC registered advisement investor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/TSNOTYAW.
Dear Cece, Carly, and Bianca, I adore the podcast and have learned so much about writing and publishing from listening to each of you. Thank you for the work each of you do to make the publishing journey more transparent and less overwhelming for emerging writers. I am seeking representation for my debut novel, Missing Eden, an 85,000-word work of upmarket women's fiction that will appeal to fans of Daisy Florin's My Last Innocent Year, and Hannah Halperin's I Could Live Here Forever, and Rebecca Mackay's I Have Some Questions for You. A campus novel, Missing Eden, follows protagonist Lucy Riley's search for her sophomore year roommate, Eden, a young woman who doesn't want to be found. College has not lived up to Lucy Riley's expectations. She hasn't made lifelong friends, discovered her passion, or found great love. She starts her sophomore year at Syracuse University, determined that this year will be different. She explores a relationship with a college Republican, writes for the school paper, and decides to befriend her new roommate, a transfer student named Eden, who is hoping for her own fresh start. When Eden goes missing at the beginning of her second semester, Lucy becomes fixated on finding her. But each time Lucy gets close, Eden slips through her fingers, leaving only the slightest traces of her presence. As Lucy digs deeper, she uncovers the darker truths of Eden's life. A tragic family situation, a shattered relationship, and involvement in an illicit enterprise. When Eden is found, hospitalized, drugged, dehydrated, and exhausted, Lucy realizes her roommate is entangled with a dangerous local drug dealer. Worse, Lucy's own actions may have contributed to Eden's unraveling. Determined to help, Lucy resolves to get Eden out of trouble, only to discover that doing so will require her to risk more than she ever imagined. Missing Eden explores the untethered nature of our college years and how, in the search for identity, a person can get lost. As Lucy searches for her missing roommate, she grapples with her own questions of identity and belonging and must learn to let go of the past to face the terrifying uncertainty of the future. I am a writer and lawyer in Pittsburgh. I have been published as a regular contributor to the New York Times and have a short story coming out in the January issue of the literary journal After Dinner Conversation. I was recently a finalist for the Ghost Story Spring 2024 Supernatural Fiction Award and was accepted to the Northern California Writing Retreat. I sit on the board of a local literary arts organization, Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures, and I'm currently at work on my second novel. All the best, Laura Mulan.
Thank you, Cece. As you were reading that, that was giving me vibes of your client's book that's actually coming out in May, Laura Leffler's Tell Them You Lied, which might be a decent comp for this. All right, so give us your word count there and your take on this.
I had the same thought, so I love that we both were reminded of Laura's upcoming novel. Okay, so from the top, I love the hook. Guess why I love the hook? Because everyone loves this hook. It's like Gone Girl, right? Like a woman goes missing. There will never be too many stories about a woman going missing if executed right. It's one of those things that's a classic. So great job with the metadata paragraph. I absolutely love it. Small note, I think you should capitalize Republican because it's referring to a member of the political party. It doesn't matter. No one's going to stop reading your query letter because of it. But, you know, we're reading it and we're going to tell you. I have a big picture note in terms of the plot, and that this is both regarding how you're framing it, but also the actual plot of the story. The line reads, Lucy becomes fixated on finding her, her being Eden, the person who does not want to be found. This is a really common mistake in these kinds of novels. So as I said, there will always be a market for compelling missing person stories. And because there will always be a market, we get a lot of queries for it. Like a lot. I see a lot of queries of this woman disappeared, this other woman is trying to find her. A very common mistake in the framing of these stories is there is no compelling reason for this person to go on this journey and find her. Going on this journey costs a lot. And there is no actual external, relatable, compelling pressure making her do it. It's more like she is curious. You know, she is all of a sudden compelled, and that is not believable. It takes, honestly, a miracle to be able to pull that off in terms of the interiority and the emotionality to make me believe that this person's going to go on this journey. And so it is up to you. But for me, a compelling motivation behind a hero's decision to embark on a quest is essential. And here, her motivation is relatable. She wants to find her roommate. Her roommate was her friend. But I think it could be stronger. If you offered a bit more context, particularly regarding antagonistic forces and or pressure points. So what do I mean by that? Here's an example. The police could get involved and rule Eden's case as a runaway, but Lucy knows better and she must do the job the police refused to do. That's a way of presenting an antagonistic force. In this case, the police aren't doing the job, and so she has to step in. Another example is, you know, the police could suspect Lucy being involved in the missing person situation. And so Lucy has to find Eden to prove that she didn't do anything to Eden. And so in this case, this is an example of adding a pressure point that is directly related to the protagonist. So the protagonist is going to be up against these external forces, and you need that. They make her life harder. They make us root for a protagonist because they make the protagonist's life harder. So again, it's up to you. I want to be clear. If I got this query letter like on a normal day, I would have very happily kept on reading and eagerly devoured the pages because it is a hook that I'm interested in, because this is very well written and I really liked your author bio paragraph. But again, I don't think that the motivation is framed in a compelling way.
Thank you, Cece. Yeah, another book for this author to potentially read is Bright Young Woman, to see the reason why a protagonist goes on that quest and, you know, what's at stake, etc. Because that's really set up very well in that book, which was super compelling. Okay, Carly, handing it across to you.
All right. So let me start off at the top here. So publishing really does love a campus novel. Like, I don't know what it is about the campus novel. Maybe it's because we're all huge nerds and we like want to be brought back to our, I don't know, roots of academia. I do wonder with campus novels whether they're going to be like YA or new adult or adult. And it's all about the tone and the approach, about how you do it. I definitely had my little antennas up trying to like decode what part this was going to land. So yeah, so letting you know, I was kind of like, okay, you pitched this as upmarket women's fiction, but to me, this is more of a mystery or a thriller than a women's fiction. So I have a feeling we haven't quite nailed our genre, you know, the context of how you want to use it in the query letter. So I just had my little antennas up around that. Okay, here's my big picture note. I'm worried we're spending way too much time on the page about this first semester where nothing happens. And then all of a sudden we get into the second semester where the missing person happens, right? So you have a whole paragraph about college hasn't lived up to Lucy's expectations, do-do-do-do-do. Next paragraph, when Eden goes missing at the beginning of her second semester, I'm like, okay, what's happening? Like, how much time is on the page in this first semester? I'm really worried at this point because I'm thinking, if we are going to spend, I don't know, a certain section of the book with just introducing us to the world of this campus, we're going to be lost really quick. And by you spending an entire paragraph talking about for semester one, that worries me. So that was another antennas going up moment. It could be we're right into the second semester and, you know, again, my antennas can go down, but that's just an example of when my antennas go up. I really like that we have some pretty high stakes here. So we get to, you know, Eden's found, hospitalized, drugged, dehydrated, exhausted. I was kind of wondering, I'm like, oh, did she just like spoil the whole book? And then we get into the, oh, actually, Lucy's own actions may have contributed to Eden's unraveling. Great. So now I'm like, okay, we're rolling here. We have something. We're cooking, as the youths say. And then I would delete the second last paragraph. I would delete the missing Eden explores the untethered nature paragraph. That's absolutely got to go. Yeah, so those are kind of my big picture notes.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, Cece, will you give us a summary of those opening pages?
So it starts with chapter one, and there are two scenes. The first scene has the protagonist walking into the dorm, and the landline is ringing, and she's alone. Her roommate isn't there, which is normal. She picks up the phone. It's Eden's mother, who doesn't know where Eden is. Again, Eden is the roommate, as a reminder. The protagonist says, you know, she's probably with her boyfriend, and she thinks to herself that it's very normal for Eden to disappear for days at a time. And then we have a line break and another scene. And that other scene has the protagonist meeting Eden on the day that Eden moved in. And, you know, the protagonist met not just Eden, but her parents. And we see her observing the family dynamics. And we also learn about the protagonist's situation, that she wanted to live off campus, but she didn't have friends to live with her. So she's trying to frame it as, oh, it's more convenient to be nearby. And yeah, that's what happens.
Okay, thank you. Do you think the author started in the right place? Are the pages doing the heavy lifting? Let's hear.
Okay. I think the most common note we give on the podcast is, this is not starting in the right place. And in fairness, it's really hard to pick the right place to start. It's why Bianca has her great circling the building analogy. This is not starting in the right place, 1,000%. I am 1,000% sure of this. Why am I so sure? Because your writing is awesome. Like, your writing is great. All the applause for the writing. I was highlighting so many things. I will get to that in a second. But when the writing is so fantastic, then you know it's an issue of not starting on the right place. You know? You know for a fact, because it's like, well, it's not the writing. It's not that this person can't write. So it's just not very compelling to have the protagonist walk into a room, not really care about anything, talk to her roommate's mother and be like, yeah, it's normal that she's missing. Cool. Like, yes, we know that the fact that she's missing is ominous because we will have read the jacket copy, but that is just a waste of words. Like, that is not where you should start. I also don't think you should start with the scene where they meet unless we're going to have a lot more time with them until she finally goes missing. I guess my question for you is, when in the story does she go missing? Like, is this dual timeline? Do we have a timeline of them being friends and then a timeline of her being missing? Or does this happen halfway? Like, I almost wish I could ask you this, because that will determine where you should start. You should play around with different starting points, but this isn't it. Like, it's, again, it's very, very, very well written. Like, all the applause for the writing, but the framing is not compelling. It's not juicy. So let us talk more about other execution issues, or not just issues, but, you know, notes. I talk a lot on the podcast about psychological acuity. Psychological acuity is the child of interiority and emotionality. If you don't know how to write interiority and emotionality, you will never know how to write psychological acuity. Psychological acuity refers to moments in the story where the author zooms out and offers a larger insight into the protagonist's psyche, into what the protagonist is observing about other people, about themselves. It reveals layers and layers of consciousness and unconsciousness. It's juicy. It's interesting. It's the why people do what they do moment. It's so, so important to novels. And all the fantastic, the greats all do it, right? And it's so hard to do. So, so hard to do. And yet it's so important to do. And I got to tell you, this might be the best example of psychological acuity I've ever seen in a query letter in the shit no one tells you about writing. Like, I am highlighting so many examples and going, this is brilliant. It's not just, like, it's subtle and it's perfectly baked into the scene. I was like, gosh, like, what did you just do to me? Like, you just attacked my soul in the best way. I loved it. It was just so, so excellent. Substack supporters, again, you'll be able to see all these really great examples. I want to read one of them, but there's so many. Like, they're just so many, and they're sprinkled in so seamlessly, so organically, so perfectly. I wanted my new roommate, whoever she was, to see it. see it being, sorry, let me give you context. So the protagonist has hung up pictures of her with friends from her first year because they're sophomores, right? I wanted my new roommate, whoever she was, to see it and to know that I was a person who was loved. I wanted to see myself that way, notwithstanding the fact that I was a sophomore living with a stranger in the dorms. Like the level of self-awareness, the acuity, the just layers and layers. There's so much to unpack here. It just makes me so curious to know more. You are clearly a person with an excellent grasp of human psychology and you know your character really, really well, which is honestly so hard to do. So like all the applause. I'm in love with your ability to do this. It's absolutely excellent. And there's so many more examples, which I will stop talking about now. Things you can improve on other than the starting in the right place. You're namesplaining a lot. Namesplaining, for those of you who don't know, is when you introduce a character and then immediately tell us who they are in a dry way. So, for example, her boyfriend, Ben Marcus, or my freshman year roommate, Julia, or her mother, Melanie, or my older sister, Amelia. This is a matter of taste, but I think that writing that is so elevated and subtle does not need namesplaining. Find an interesting and compelling way to tell me who these people are that makes me, the reader, be a co-pilot and not a passenger in your story. I don't want to be passively fed this information, especially because you are introducing some people twice. Like we get to my roommate, Julia's. So you definitely don't need to do that. I know it sounds like a minor note, but this is a sign of you not either not trusting your reader or not trusting yourself, sometimes both. And I promise you, I am promising you, you can trust your writing. Believe me, I almost never say this. You can trust your writing. Your writing is very, very intelligent. You absolutely don't need it. So I really like this. I'm curious to read more. No one's ever pressured, no one's ever obligated to send me anything, but whenever this is ready, I would love to read it.
Wonderful, Cece. Thank you. Yeah, and for our listeners, sometimes it makes the reader more actively curious if we don't know who Marcus or Amelia are. You know, if we're like, oh, this name has been dropped. Who is this person? I'm going to keep reading to try and figure it out. So you don't always have to give reader instant context. Sometimes it's nice to just make them curious. Okay, Carly, your take?
All right. Okay, I'm going to start with the opening bit about the phone ringing. I felt like, again, I think I talked about this in the last one, but there's an opportunity for a timestamp here because when a landline is ringing, and these are essentially teenagers, like if you're in sophomore, right, you're potentially, you know, 19, 20, somewhere in there, maybe even 18. Having a landline is weird. It's odd. It's strange. It's, you know, in a lot of dorms, there will be obviously a plug-in and a jack. And so we kind of get into that, but it really made me go like, I don't know, is this from the early 2000s or like when is this? And it just made me feel like this is when I went to university because when I went to college, it was, I did have a phone. And then my second year of university is actually when I got my first cell phone ever, aging myself as an elder millennial. But I don't know, that was a bit interesting to me because clearly there's something, she's trying to say something about the fact that there's a landline. I'm jumping immediately to where we went in the query letter, which was it's for nefarious reasons, potentially that there, you know, there's the landline cell phone combo. So anyway, so that flagged for me, talking about my antennas going up. My antennas were going up there. Next thing I want to talk about is I haven't done my brand rant in a while. So I'm going to do my brand rant, which is when you talk about brands, there's a lot of pressure on you if you're going to name the thing. So you do this a couple of times in your pages. You talk about a Longchamp bag, and then you talk about some Kate Spade clothing, and then you talk about car brands. I always feel like it's risky behavior because somebody who knows a lot about different brands, whether it's, you know, again, fashion and whatnot, there's a whole history of that brand. And essentially brands are symbols. Brands are symbols of something, right? So if you're saying, you know, this bag that she brought was from Target versus Longchamp versus Chanel. Like these are different things. These are something you're saying about her social standing. It's about how she recognizes what she owns. It's about what she recognizes in other people, talking about her roommate's mother wearing a Kate Spade dress. So there's always an opportunity there. We're actually saying so much more than what we're saying when we name a brand. And so I went into in my notes, you know, what a Longchamp bag represents in terms of a brand. And this all can be summed up in, you know, if you guys are Succession fans, when they talk about the Burberry bag and when he goes on the rant about the capacious bag. And anyway, so there's so many examples of talking about what brands represent in pop culture or movies or television or books. So that's my brand rant. Just be really careful about when you are naming something. What does it mean? What are you trying to say? Are you accomplishing that? And I think you do a pretty good job at this. This is more like my brand rant for everybody because we're on the podcast. Because later on, you talk about, you know, recognizing again that she's wearing that dress. Dress is fancier than your parents and recognizing the labels and the brands of the cars. So I do think when we're talking about coming of age, it's very natural to think about your class within the kind of institutional system of something like education and higher education. And we learn the fact that she had a scholarship. And so potentially she's not as well off as some of her compatriots in her class. So anyway, that's my brand rant. You heard it before. You'll hear it again. I will always do my brand rant.
Can I interrupt and do Tom talking to Greg? Greg, it's monstrous. It's gargantuan. You could take it camping. I think he mentioned something about being able to put shoes on the subway. I used to have bags. I used to put most of my shoes in my bag so I could take the subway because I felt so seen with that. I was like, I am the tacky person that they would be making fun of.
And then this is a perfect thing because that bag was a Burberry brand, and anybody who had a Burberry bag after that was like, well, am I a part of this group of people that is, you know, ridiculous? And so when you name a brand, like anything, when you're naming it in fiction, how we feel about Longchamp as a brand, you know, could change in the future. So whenever you name anything, whether it's a brand or, you know, a business, you know, I talk about that a lot on the show. If you're going to name something, we don't know how it's going to kind of come off or be canceled or go under, you know, for example, like think about Martha Stewart, right? Like the Martha Stewart brand, right? She was at the height of her, you know, pinnacle of her business. And then it goes, you know, completely under. So anyway, I'll get off my brand rant. I just have to do my brand rant.
It makes me laugh because it makes me think of my friend who bought his Tesla ages ago, and now he's actually got a sticker on the Tesla that's like, I bought this car before Elon Musk was a psychopath. Please don't scratch my car, because people in Chicago are going around scratching Teslas.
So,
and when he bought it, he was like, oh, I have a Tesla. Look how great it is. And now he's like, please don't hurt my car. So yeah, good point. Carlin, Cece, thank you so much again for your incredible insights. For our Substack supporters, you can go in. Remember, the Tuesday after the episode airs, in that edition is when you will find all the written critiques. So the word nerds can go through all of those. And we'll be back again with another Books with Hooks in 2 weeks' time. Next week, we have an author interview. See you all then. Bye.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Litera Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Litera Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Would you like to stand a chance of winning a registration for our upcoming Deep Dive virtual retreat so you can learn from incredible agents, editors, and authors while also having the chance of winning life-changing prizes? Head to theshitaboutwriting.com and go to the Deep Dive page. Scroll down past all the details of the amazing lineup to find an image that you can share on your socials along with the reasons why you would like to attend. Use the hashtag #DeepDiveOrBust and tag the podcast. Each post gets you a ticket into the draw. The contest ends at midnight on the 23rd of January, and the winner will be announced on the 24th. We hope it's going to be you.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for the writer in your life? Are you the favorite writer in your life and you want to gift yourself something awesome? Then come take a look at the Ultimate Planner for Writers for 2025. It not only allows you to plan for your regular day-to-day with hourly time slots, it also allows you to brainstorm, research, plot, outline, do scene planning, and vision boarding all in one. And it's available as a physical planner or as an e-planner. Check out Bianca Murray and find the Planner for Writers tab for more information. Remember to order early to avoid the end of year rush.